Okay, this is a seminar on financial management. Let me tell you a couple stories just to start out. But first, let me know how many of you are pastors. The rest are non-pastors. Pastors' wives? Okay. The rest are non-pastors. Good. Glad to have you. I was traveling from Chicago to Minneapolis in 1978. And decided to take the scenic way home. So I drove up the river, along the Mississippi River, through the Prairie du Chien towns and so on. It's beautiful. And I loved traveling on these little back roads. Began to get close to running out of gas. Stopped at this little dinky town, this little dinky gas station. And this older fellow was in the back working on some cars. And I realized I didn't have any money. No cash. I might have had a dollar in cash. And I had a conference account checkbook from Colorado Springs. So I went in this guy and wanted to fill up my car with gas, and he said, well, I don't take checks. And I said, I don't have much cash, so you've got to take a check, because I'm out of gas, I don't think I can make the next town. So we got into a bit of a friendly sparring match there about whether he was going to take this check from Colorado from an organization, the Navigators, he'd never heard of. And I was doing everything I could to convince him that it would be a good check. And I finally made my crowning statement was, look, I'm a missionary. I'm in full-time Christian service. He looked me in the eye and said, it's all the more reason I'm not going to take your check. Well, I didn't say the right thing. Last month, I was talking with a friend of mine who's a credit manager of an office supply company in Omaha. And I said, you know, I've heard that pastors, missionaries, Christian workers, I was including me in that group, I said, I've heard that we're not very good credit risks for companies. Is that right? He said, it's exactly right. Being the credit manager, he finds out who's a good risk and who's not. And he said, the people we have the most trouble with collecting from in our town are churches and preachers. And he said, often when we send them out a notice that something's 60 days, 90 days overdue, they'll send in the original amount, finally, but they won't pay the service charge. He said that the non-Christians pay the service charge, but the Christians don't. And he said, the men I work with in the office, a lot of the non-Christians, they see all this happening. And they see how some of the churches and pastors and missionaries relate to the service charge and being late in their bills. It's not a very good testimony. So I'm afraid that we have a reputation that we have to overcome. Now, those of you that are non-pastors, of course, you can gloat a bit now, but some of you probably would be encouraged by some of this as well. Let's take a look at a verse of Scripture starting out here. Luke 16, verses 10 to 12. Luke 16, 10 to 12. Now, you know the context of the unrighteous steward. In verse 10 it says, he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous mammon, who will entrust the true riches to you? The NIV says, if you have not been faithful in handling worldly wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? There's something more valuable than money. There's something called the true riches. What are the true riches? Well, the Bible doesn't really tell us what they are, but we can assume that they're eternal because it's contrasted with the mammon, which is temporal. We can assume that it's something that lasts forever, and it's something from God, these true riches, and they're more valuable than mammon. Now, if you and I don't handle mammon properly, the non-true riches, we will never be allowed to be entrusted with true riches. This is a very penetrating verse for me, and I think it's one that all of us as pastors and Christian workers and laborers ought to be aware of, because I think oftentimes we have the idea that money is not that important and it's a temporal thing and it's all going to burn anyway, and let's get on to the more important stuff. My wife reminded me one time, she said, Scott, you give me the impression that you're too spiritually minded to be concerned with a car breaking down or getting the bills paid on time. And she was exactly right. And we never used to consider paying our bills on time or being faithful in our giving or being faithful in financial matters as really a virtue. But this verse, I believe, speaks otherwise. John MacArthur, I listened to a tape of his a while ago, who he said, quote, "I know lots of preachers who now have no ministry because they couldn't manage money." Now, I have no reason to doubt that that's not true. And you may know some, and I know one or two. So we've got to get serious about handling our money properly. Where do we start? Well, there's lots of good books on financial management these days. You could go to a bookstore and even good Christian books. But I'd like to suggest that you start with the Bible. Let's make that our first stopping place. I put a handout there for you on, it's a simple Bible study on financial matters. Let's take a look at that first and just go over a couple of these things briefly. My goal is to whet your appetite to study this in such a way that you'll be able to pass it on to some of your friends. And particularly, maybe some of the elders in your church. Okay, here's some passages on how to become poor. And that's something we'd all like to know, isn't it? How on earth can you really become poor? Well, here's some keys. You've heard of the promises in the Bible. Well, here's some promises. Let's take a look at the first one, Proverbs 10:4. Now, I won't take these in order necessarily. Here's an exciting promise from the Scripture. Proverbs 10:4. Got it?
I'll get them.
This is the one called Handling Money Biblically. There you go. All right, Proverbs 10:4. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So what's the secret of becoming poor? Working with a negligent hand. That's a promise from the Scripture. If you work with a negligent hand, you'll become poor. Isn't that exciting? Now, a person that works with a negligent hand isn't trying to become poor. They're not malicious about it. It's just that I forgot. And we might say careless. That would be another word there. Proverbs 14:23. We're working from the bottom up here. Proverbs 14:23. In all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. Now there's another promise from the Scripture that if you're just a talker but not a doer, poverty will come your way. I think you probably all know of people who are big talkers about money. A friend of mine back in Minneapolis had, in his billfold, he had a piece of paper tape that said $100,000. He said, that's my goal, make $100,000 this year. And every time I open my billfold, that reminds me of that goal. Fact is, he was just a talker. He was into selling frozen bananas at the state fair and that kind of stuff to make his $100,000. It was always a scam, always a scheme going on. Of course, he never made it. Proverbs 21:5. Here's another exciting key in becoming poor. The plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. Being hasty, making quick decisions. Now, Elma and I have made a rule that we're not going to buy things on impulse. And if we have a vacuum cleaner salesman or somebody come, we always say, no, we can't decide right now. We actually pray about these decisions. Of course, that kind of shocks them a bit, too. But it's good to not make quick decisions, especially in the matter of finances. Proverbs 20, verse 4. I don't think that's on the list. You may want to add that one. Proverbs 20, verse 4. The sluggard does not plow after the autumn, so he begs during the harvest and has nothing. Well, how do you become? What's the key to becoming poor there? I think it's not planning ahead. It's not planning ahead. The King James says the sluggard does not plow by reason of the cold. It's cold to get out there and plow after the harvest. It's not very convenient. But if we think ahead, we realize if I don't plow, I won't have anything next year. So we got to plan ahead. I think that's another principle. Okay, well, now let's talk about some things that are better than money. The next section. What is better than having wealth? Proverbs 16:16 would be one. 16:16. How much better it is to get wisdom than gold. Right on. What's better than money? Wisdom. Much better to have wisdom. Chapter 17, verse 1. Better is a dry morsel in quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. Better to have a quiet home than to have a home where there's all kinds of feasting, all kinds of provisions, money, material things, but it's not happy. Proverbs 22, verse 1. Here's something else that's better than money. A good name is more to be desired than great riches. I'd rather have a good name than silver and gold. I'd rather have a good reputation. Where I grew up in Iowa, there were a kind of a family of farmers who, they did all right financially. They bought up all kinds of land. But nobody liked the way they did it. So their reputation was poor, even though they were very wealthy. My granddad used to quote a thing from Shakespeare. I think it's the only thing he knew from Shakespeare, but this is what it was. He who steals my purse steals trash, but he who takes from me my good name steals all that I have. That's close to being biblical. It's better to have a good name, to be a woman of integrity, than to have money. 28:6. Proverbs 28:6. Better is the poor who walks in his integrity than he who is crooked, though he be rich. It's better to have integrity than money. Now let me add one more. Proverbs 31:10. That's not on your notes. An excellent wife who can find, her worth is far above jewels. Men, it's better to have an excellent wife than to be loaded. Wouldn't you rather have that than just plain money? Now these next passages down here, this next section, are some pretty basic scriptures about the use of money. And we won't take the time to go through those today. But let me encourage you to, in fact, if you want to pick up an extra handout, take this home with you and share this with your deacons. Share this with your elders. Share this with the men or women you're meeting with one-on-one. Just pass that Bible study sheet across the table and say, today, instead of talking about all our problems, let's do a Bible study. And this is a critical topic. And this simple Bible study, I believe, will really whet people's appetites. And we've gone through it rather quickly here, but if you take time to meditate on each verse with that person, you know, they'll find it very interesting. And they'll know of situations, and they'll look at their own life and say, I've made that mistake. I've been too hasty in our finances. You can open up a whole new world with the people you're discipling if you'll get them to look at what the Bible has to say about money. Of course, the Bible has a lot to say about money. We've just nibbled at the surface here. Okay, any questions on using this, or I want you to have this as a tool, something you can use for your own life and something you can pass on to somebody else. Now there's another study I've got over here in my notes. It's a little more in depth on money and asks some penetrating questions about money. You could take that along too, but this is a good starting point. Now just having the deacons do this Bible study for the first half hour of the deacon meeting some night, you know, before you fight about the money later in the evening, I've been a deacon. I know how that went in our church. There's three questions I like to answer, and then Russ is going to talk about more long-range planning in the last half hour. But I want to cover, how can I control spending? And we got some questions that you filled out, and we're addressing those in this. And then we'll leave the last half hour of our time together for any questions or comments that you have. How can I control my spending? Where does the money go? Why is there so much of the month left at the end of the check? So let's talk about how to spend wisely the money that we have. And I believe the answer for stewards is budgeting. Now that used to be kind of a bad word for me. I didn't like the word. I felt threatened by it. I felt it was the budget would keep me from doing God's will. I wanted to be led by the Spirit here and there. But I found that a budget really helps. One of the verses that I like in this regard is Psalms 32, 8, and 9. Now, I don't think the psalmist was writing this with a budget in mind, but it certainly applies. Psalms 32, 8, and 9. I will instruct you and teach you in the way in which you should go. I will guide you with my eye upon you. It's a great promise of God's guidance. But verse 9 says, don't be like the horse or the mule which have no understanding, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle lest they come near thee. So we are to count on God leading us, but we're also not to be like a horse or mule, who simply, when they feel the bit pulling in their mouth, they turn. They don't have to think. We are to think. We are to plan. Proverbs 27:23. Know well the conditions of your flock. You know, my dad knew every hog in our farm just by looking at its face. To me, they all looked alike. They were white with polka dots. But to my dad, he knew everyone individually. And we need to know our financial matters. We need to know them well. I used to feel funny taking time to sit and plan and think and pray about our finances. But it must be done. All right, speaking about budgeting then, take a look at the family budget that you have before you there. Everyone have this? Now, this is any kind of a budget form will work pretty well, but this is one that I've found helpful, and this is one that I use with our Navigator staff. You put here your monthly gross salary, then other monthly income you may have, total monthly income, subtract the taxes that come out of that, and then subtract your giving, whatever you're going to give right away, and that leaves you with what you've got to spend during that month's time. Then here are the categories where you add up what you like to spend. And if the total monthly spending figure here at the bottom is in excess of this net spendable here at the top, then there's a problem. Now, how do you know how much you should have in each category? And that was one of the questions that came up. Larry Burkett, who has written several books about finances, and I'm not trying to say that we all ought to agree with everything Larry Burkett says, but in the one book I read, he gave some percentages for each of these things that I thought was very helpful. Let me just give you those as a starting point. He suggested that housing be 30 to 40% of your net spendable, not your gross, but your net spendable. And a lot of it depends on the area you live and, of course, the kind of house you live in and so on. But that would include not only your mortgage or rent, but also your utilities and most of your house payment, your house expenditures. Now, I've got phone in there. That probably could be broken out into a different category. But that's what he said, 30 to 40%. Food, he said 24%. Now, of course, as most of the women here know, food is not just food. It's also the things you can't eat, all the paper products and so on. That amounts to a fairly large portion. Auto, he suggested 13%. Debts, he suggested no more than 7%. And of course, this, if you don't have a debt, you're not going out to look for one. But if you have debts, plan on spending at least 7% of your spendable income to reduce that debt. Insurance, he said 6%. Clothing, 5 to 7%. Entertainment, 6%. Elma and I call it family fun. That's more the way we look at that. Medical and dental, 5%, and savings, 4%. Now, this is kind of a rule of thumb. Let's not stick religiously to these things, but that gives a guide. But I do know for sure that if we go above 40% in our housing, then I think we're flirting with danger. 40% of your housing, more than 40% of net spendable for housing, it just tightens everything else up. Let me give another set of figures here, which are based on what he has suggested here is several years old, and I think was based on a little lower income than we have now. That was based on maybe $1,200 a month spendable. I think it's more like $1,500 to $2,000 spendable for a lot of people. Let me suggest a different set of figures. I'd go ahead with housing, a maximum of 40%. Food supplies, I would think 15 to 20% with a little higher income. Auto, I'd suggest we try to keep that at about 10%. Now, of course, I realize a lot of this depends on the level of income. Debt repayment, 7 to 10. I'd encourage you to put it up. If you have a debt, let's get rid of it as fast as we can. A person asked me the other day, he said, I've got a fairly low college loan I haven't paid off yet, and it's fairly low rate, and I'm in no hurry to pay it off. And I encourage her to pay it off as quickly as she could. I believe it's Proverbs 3:27 says, don't say to your neighbor, go and come back again, I'll pay you when I have the money. If it's in your power to do good, do the good. I think that's Proverbs 3:27. So I encourage her to pay it off as quickly as possible. Entertainment or recreation, I'm thinking more like 3%. No fun. Clothing, 5%. Medical or dental, 5%. And savings, 10%. Seems to me that 4% is pretty slim, especially if you're trying to save for to replace your car, which is a good thing to do because you don't want to be paying a high car rates. It's a depreciating item. Okay, so that...
Figure on the insurance?
Yeah, I left that at 6. Now those add up to 99 or 101% or something, but this gives you a kind of a rule of thumb. And if you veer very far from these, why, you could be headed for trouble. The Burkett bases that on, you know, what a lot of people do over a lot of years, so it's pretty well tested. Now, how do you control spending? Well, let's say your income is $1,500 a month. That's what your net spendable turns out to be. That means that for family fun, then, you're going to spend 3% of that, $1,500. $45 a month is for family fun. Now, the way to make a budget, then, is to take a notebook and just take these various categories and plug in your notebook the actual dollar amount that's going to be, and then you have to keep track of how much you spent on that month, and if you go over, you've got to stop. So you can do it with a notebook, and that works very well for some people. But let me give one other alternative to keeping a budget that is simpler than a notebook. Elm and I are not big on keeping records. If I had to write in a notebook every time I bought a popsicle or something, I don't think I'd do it. It's just a lot of upkeep. So I'd like to introduce you to the envelope system. Now this is so simple that you just wonder if it can really work. What Elm and I do, and these aren't our actual figures, but these are, I give this for example only. When we get our paycheck, which comes once a month in the Navigators, we put the money in the bank and we take out our savings first. This is after we take the amount we've got for sale. We take that out, get it out. Because if you leave it in that checking account, it's gone. And if you try to save on what you got left at the end of the month, it won't save anything. So we take that out, and then we hold enough in there for our mortgage payment, for our giving, for any other fixed expenses. But then on the rest, which is mostly the things in the right column here, for our church giving, we often do that with cash every week. And we just every week use a church envelope and we put the cash down. So we'll have an envelope for that, and these all go in the dresser drawer. So you got tons of cash laying around the first of the month. Don't worry, it'll be gone in no time, and there'll be nothing to steal. Then we put our auto. That's another envelope that we keep, and that's in the dresser drawer. And then we got one for operating. That's kind of miscellaneous. Paperboy, the kids need something for school. School lunch. We found that, you know, we were writing out checks all the time for school lunch, and we went to an envelope system there. Entertainment. Be another one. Clothing. Food. And you can have as many envelopes as you like. But we have found that the envelope system really controls our spending. Now, here's the secret of it. When the envelope is empty, let's say it's the 1st of October and we've gotten paid, and now it's the 15th of October and we look and there's nothing there. Well, that's it. There's no more spending on food for the month. It's done. Now, that seems pretty simple, doesn't it? But it works. When we go to buy some clothing and there's no clothing money there, it's done. Now, we might have some left in entertainment, but there's not holes in these envelopes where the money kind of slides from one to the other. You may not switch envelopes. That's the 11th commandment. If you don't switch envelopes, then you will have to live with that budget. Now, it may be that you start out, you think, well, clothing, six, boy, that's a little too high. So you may want to, you know, it'll take you a couple months to readjust it till you find you get it about right. Maybe $250 for groceries is too small. It'll take a few months to get it right, but once you get it, stick with it. And you will control your spending. And the rule is, when it's gone, it's gone. And Alma and I believe that if it's gone, and we have other needs, then we believe that either we've planned so poorly, or that God has not substantiated those other needs, and therefore we don't need them. So there may be a sale on shoes, but the clothing envelope is empty, and God has not substantiated that need for shoes. Okay, questions or comments? It embarrasses us to death, but yes, we do. We keep them in the dresser drawer and pray we won't get robbed. And then when Elma goes to the grocery store, she takes the food envelope, sticks in her purse. Sometimes she takes two or three envelopes in case she might need something else.
Like the gasoline.
Yeah, Then when I go to look for an envelope, it's in her purse.
What about interest-bearing checking accounts? You know, wouldn't the money be thinner in the bank?
You'd sure think so, would you? Well, you'd make a little money. But how much would it be? A few dollars a year. I would rather, and then of course, when you spend it, you zip that down to zero anyway. See, everybody's broke a couple weeks before payday anyway, so you're going to take that money down. There's nothing to draw interest anyway, or very little. But if you have it in a checking account, it's harder to control, at least we found. Because when the envelope's empty, it's gone, and that's it. But when you realize and you keep records that your food, $250, is due on the checkbook, you say, well, but you know there's another $100 there, so you write it out anyway. This is for the undisciplined people, which Alma and I are. It works. So you'd lose a few dollars, yes, but over a year's time, if it would be $10, I'd be surprised. Also, then, if you have a separate checking account for it, you got a service charge for the checks. If you ever bounce one. And people are amazed. You bring this cash up to the grocery store. You know, what's that? That's money. Have you ever heard of that? You know, not a credit card. No, not a credit card. Okay, that's enough on budgeting. Anything else on budgeting? All right, let's talk about credit cards. Let me read you a newspaper article here. About a couple called the Sloans. Before they sought help, the Sloans had two auto loans and 32 credit cards with running balances and absolutely no idea of how much expendable income they really had. We never had a budget, Jonathan said. We never deferred buying something we wanted. We both came from families that traded in the car every 3 years, had an annual vacation, and some weekend trips. The reason they got where they were in serious financial trouble is because they represent the new class, the affluent, or the striving to appear so, who are earning more than their parents did. We're the generation who never expected not to get what they wanted. And here they are, sitting across the desk from us, absolutely flabbergasted they can't have everything at once. They can't spend more than they earn year after year. That's a shock for a lot of young people today. At one point, the Sloans took a bank loan to consolidate their debts, so all the credit cards were paid off. And they had one loan now from a bank instead of 32 small loans out there with credit card companies. But what that does is that frees up those credit cards for you to charge even more because the balance is down to zero. The credit card company says, hey, your balance is down to zero. Borrow some more. And so they ran it up again. So there's stories like this all the time. Now, a credit card is a form of borrowing. It's a 30-day loan. And what does the Bible have to say about credit cards? Well, it doesn't have anything to say about credit cards, but it does say something about borrowing. One of the scriptures, Psalms 37:21, says, the wicked borrows, but does not pay back, but the righteous is gracious and gives. Now, most of us aren't malicious about not paying back. We don't do it out of spite, but we're just late in our bills. It says, the wicked borrows, but does not pay back. So if we're not paying our credit cards back, that's a debt we owe. We're not paying it back. I'm a bit surprised at some, I'm speaking of NAV staff mostly, I guess, but some of them have, you know, substantial credit card bills run up, and they're not getting them paid off in each month. If you have a credit card and you can pay it off within the 30 days and there's no service charge, I think that's fine. They're a great help. So I'm not trying to say that the Bible or Russ and I are categorically against credit cards. But it is a 30-day loan, which you should pay off within 30 days, or otherwise you're going to be charged 19 to 21% on those cards. And of course, the loan companies want you to string that out as far as you can because they make more. They make some off the grocery store or the gas station. They make 5% off them. They make 19% off you. Pretty profitable. Romans 13:8 says, owe no one anything except to love one another. Proverbs 3:27, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. If you have the money to pay off a loan, pay it off. It's in your power to do it. And Proverbs 22:7 says, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. As long as you owe somebody money, they are your boss. Now, what about home loans and so on like that? Well, you're not technically in debt if you can quickly liquidate and quickly pay off your debt. So that'd be all right. But the problem comes when we can't quickly liquidate and we can't quickly get out of it. That's the problem. Or if you were to liquidate and find that what you liquidated wasn't enough to pay off the whole thing, then that is true debt. Okay, does someone have a credit card here? Let's just have a little fun with one of these. Does somebody have one that you could loan to us? Do you have? Boy, you got a lot of them there. Good work. All right, here's a good one, a Visa card. Okay, now what we're going to do with this card is... Did you know that if you don't use credit cards, you'll spend 26% less overall? The study's been done of using credit cards, not using them. You spend 26% less. So some months you just have to save some money. Just don't use it. And it's likely you'll spend quite a bit less. If you find that you don't have any control over the use of this plastic, then they've got to be cut up. There's just no other way. And this couple of Sloans that I told you about, they made this couple sit and watch while the credit card counselor cut up every one of their credit cards right in front of their eyes and dropped them in the wastebasket. And that was the only alternative. And if you don't have the discipline on it, then let me encourage you, get rid of them. Putting them in a preheated oven at 400 degrees will also pretty much do the job. Okay, let me give you a poem here on budgeting and on borrowing that I found helpful. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. Let's try saying that together, shall we? Because if you go home with this, this isn't a Bible verse, but it's very helpful. Okay, let's say it together. Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. I like that. And it's amazing how much money you can save just by not always having to buy something new when something is looking a little shabby. Okay, any other questions or comments on credit cards or borrowing?
I have a question kind of related to the mortgage and stuff like that. We had a house fire and we paid off the mortgage and we ended up with a fairly substantial amount of money. We built the house ourselves, so we didn't have a lot of money. The next time when we go to build a house again, is it better to use all that money and pay off as much mortgage as we can and borrow less, or is there an investment that we made where you're gaining more interest than your mortgage is? Say you get a mortgage for 9.5%, 10%. What's the trade-off there?
Okay, good question. Let me make a comment, then Russ, maybe you'd have a comment on that. It used to be in the mid-70s that you could get a lot of, your house would multiply quicker than the money would someplace else. So you'd put very little in the house because that money would multiply quickly. But nowadays, houses aren't appreciating as much as they used to, so it might be wise not to sock as much as you can in there because that money's not going to appreciate. But the other factor is, what can you afford every month? If you hold your equity out and put just 10% down, and you've got $10,000 here, and you're doing other things with that money, that'd be fine. But if that monthly mortgage payment then is $100, $200 higher, if you can't afford that and that puts you under financial pressure, then it wouldn't be wise to do. Now there is some value in not socking all your equity into your house. But I think you have to be wise as to what you can afford on that. Russ, maybe you have another comment on how much equity should be plugged into a house.
I think your comments are appropriate. I would say another factor is what you're most comfortable with. Yeah. Some people, it's really important to have a house paid for. Other people, that's the last thing they want to do. So I think it's a personal decision. I think if you keep money out, it's important that you have a plan for those funds and not spend it on skiing or whatever. I think that's. I think the best. One criteria for a good investment is whatever helps you sleep at night. Seriously.
Also, depending on how long you plan to stay in the house, if you're going to turn the house over every 2 or 3 years, sell it again, that might be another factor. Going to keep it for a long time, the rest of your life, why? Then maybe get good to pay it off as quickly as possible. Good question. Lots of different answers to that question.
All right.
What's that?
It's all subjective, right?
Well, I think there's some objective guidelines, like what is the purpose for the... If you keep the money out, why are you keeping it out? If it's just to hoard or to give you a little nest egg that you don't know what you're going to do with, then it's questionable. But if it's, for example, if you kept a little out to start a kids' education fund, that might be, you know, that would certainly be true. Or to start a couple of IRAs or something. Yeah, that'd be fine. All right, let's talk about savings. How can I succeed at saving? Let me give you two words. Defer consumption. Defer consumption. My daughter found a picture of Scrooge, you know, the Christmas Scrooge, this gnarled old man counting his money. And she sent me that Christmas card, and on the back it said, "Dad, just wanted to remind you to defer consumption." So you can tell what I built into her life. A couple of passages here. Some people wonder, is it really biblical even to save? I mean, Matthew 6:33, God takes care of the birds, He takes care of the flowers. Seek first the kingdom and He'll take care of you as well. And I used to be convinced that insurance and savings was wrong as a young believer. One of the guys in our ministry that had been discipling several of us said, "I will not have insurance, I will not have savings, God will take care of me." And that's what I believed for several years. But I've come to see it a little differently now, especially since I've been married. And Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 8 says, "Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no chief or ruler gathers her food in the summer and consumes it in the winter." You know, ants are smart. They have a cash flow problem, so they save up and store up ahead of time. Proverbs 30, verses 24 and 25 says, "The ants are not a strong folk, but they prepare their food in the summer." Now, God commends what the ants are doing. Ants are smart. Maybe smarter than we are sometimes. Proverbs 13:22 says that a wise man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. Proverbs 13:22. Not suggesting that we ought to therefore try to, you know, leave these big, giant inheritances to our grandchildren, but at least it says a wise man, a good man. There's nothing wrong with having some accumulation. If you're going to leave some inheritance to somebody, there's got to be some accumulation. Proverbs 21:20 says, "There is precious treasure and oil in the dwelling of the wise." Now what that means is there had to be some accumulation. The next verse says, "The foolish spends it all, uses it all up." So is there anything wrong with accumulation? No, not necessarily. It depends on what it's used for. The other interesting thing about birds is, being an amateur bird watcher, when you see birds flying around, what are they doing? Are they socializing? What are they? Most of the time they're looking for food. God has provided food for them, but they have to look for it. It's not like it comes to them. So maybe there's a principle in the birds for us as well. All right, let me ask you a question. What are your financial goals? What would you like to do financially before you die? I think before you can save, you have to have some financial goals. It's like Russ said, what is the purpose for that money? So, on a blank sheet of paper, and maybe you and your wife, ask yourselves the question, what are our financial goals? There's nothing wrong with having financial goals. I used to think it was even sin to think about financial goals, because it would be hoarding. Well, not if our attitude's right. Some people, that is their attitude. But I think biblically, I want to give you a couple of examples here. What about your kids' education? Do you want to pay for all of it, part of it, none of it? Let's make a decision on that rather than default. So you may write a goal like this. Our financial goals, number one, is to have enough money saved by 1995 so we can supply half of our children's education. Then how much would that be? Well, in 1995, what will it cost to go to college for a year? Well, right now the average cost at a private school is $10,199 per year for to send a kid to private school. Multiply that times four if they make it out in four, and you've got what it costs to send the kid. To a public institution, it's $5,600 today to send a kid to school. Multiply that times four. Of course, in 1995, that'll be probably even higher. Another question, what do you want to be able to do in old age, in retirement? Do you want to be able to travel? You want to be able to go around and visit your kids whenever you feel like it? Would you like to take a trip to visit some missionary friends in Asia? What would you like to do in old age, and then what will it cost you? I found that a lot of things that I'd like to do always have a price tag on the end of them. That's what our financial goal is. What about... maybe you'd like to get a house that the two of you have always kind of dreamed about but never had. Maybe you need to start thinking about that for old age. Maybe there's a hobby that you'd like to do that would be kind of a bonus in life. Let me encourage you to put these bonuses down and then put a dollar amount beside them. That becomes your financial goal. And these have to be prayed over. They're nothing more than prayer lists. And if the Lord endorses your desires for these things, this trip, providing for your kids, whatever, then you can start month by month to set aside to save for it. But I think we have to have a goal. We're not just saving for the sake of saving. That's hoarding. We always have to have a reason for a savings account. Now, the overlay that you have here on savings account categories, I found very helpful. In 1968, I was working for the Columbia Daily Tribune. I made $125 a week. And man, I thought that was big money. But I noticed we got paid every Wednesday. And I noticed on about Monday, we were always broke. There was no money left. And so we just hold our breath for 2 days, and then I get paid again. And then the next Monday, we were always broke. And I thought about, you know, Alma, we need to save. And so we decided we were going to save some money based on what we had left of our check. Well, we never had anything left. We never saved anything for 6 to 8 months. And then we said, now we're going to save out of the top. So I took that $125 and put it in the bank, and I took $10 out and put $10 in a different institution. I walked across the street and put it in a savings and loan because I didn't want to be tempted to spend that extra $10. And I did that every week. At the end of 4 weeks, a month, we had $40. Now, that didn't seem like much, but we had enough by the time we left Missouri to pay for our moving truck and to pay for all our costs of moving. Now, we were still broke on Monday night. But we had $10 in the bank at least, and we were still broke. I found that if you take the savings out first, you can get by on the rest of the month. You can live, if you take out 10%, you can live on the 90%. You can get by. And we need to do that, because if you wait until the end, it won't happen. Here's what we do now. Let's say I'm going to save $200 a month. That's my goal. And so on 9/24 from my salary, I save $200, and then I break it into categories. I'm going to put $100 into emergency. I've got to save for my tax and insurance on my house because the mortgage company doesn't take that out, so I've got to save up for that. I'm going to put $25 a month away toward old age, $25 towards my kids' education, and $25 toward a vacation. Vacation is really good for a family morale, and not that we have to have one every year, not that it has to be expensive, but Elma and I have found a vacation or Christmas, it's good to start setting aside a little bit each month. Then the next month, I take another $200 and add $100 in emergency, $25 here. You can see how it adds up. The third month, you do the same. Now over here on this side, you're listing your balance, $200, $400, $600. So there's $600 that's saved, $200 of it, $300 is in emergency, and then these other categories, it adds up to $600. Then when you take something out, you take it out of the proper category. Very simple, but most people aren't doing this. Now, another thing you need to note is that there's no little gates between these columns here. Got that? Water does not run sideways. You can't pull out of one account to feed another. When the vacation fund, there's $75 in that, that's all your vacation better cost this year. You got a $75 vacation come up. You can't take the whole $600. Okay, questions or comments about savings? Now, after you get a bit built up here, you may want to say, if you get $1,000 in your emergency, you may want to pull that out and start over. And pull that out and put that into a mutual fund or something that would earn higher interest than just the bank would pay. That'd be fine. In fact, it'd be a good idea. And by the way, a bank is not necessarily the best place to save money, but it's convenient and it's a good way to get started. Okay, I'd like to introduce Russ Reed. Russ has been with the Navigators since sometime in the late 50s, I believe, and he's been the Glen Eyrie director here for several years, served in the field ministries in Texas, and now has been in our development department for about 8 years, and he works in deferred giving, and he's going to talk to us about longer-term investments. Russ?
There are four basic approaches to any kind of contingency. There's avoidance, reduction, retention, and transfer. And all of us in this room probably are utilizing all those, whether we know or familiar with the terms or not. Let's take a look at risk avoidance. There may be someone here who doesn't like to fly, is afraid of flying. I know people who are terrified of getting on an airplane Why? Because they're afraid the airplane is going to crash. They avoid that risk. They don't fly on airplanes. Some people in Colorado Springs, is a joke, you know, pray for me, I drive Academy Boulevard. Some people I know living in the city will not drive Academy Boulevard. It's kind of a wild street. A lot of traffic. They avoid having an auto accident by, in their opinion, not driving Academy Boulevard. So that's risk avoidance. Risk reduction. You might be afraid of being seriously injured in an auto crash, so what do? You regularly put on your seatbelt. You've avoided the risk. Risk retention. Frankly, I'm not too concerned about catching a cold. If I do catch a cold, you know, I'd be over it in about 10 days. But I have some friends who have cancer, and they're very concerned about catching a cold. So they, I retain the risk. They conversely avoid it best they can. If I have a cold, I'm in a meeting with them, they ask me to leave, or I don't go. Or risk transfer, and that involves insurance. You give the risk to somebody else. So let's take a look at some insurance, types of insurance. Life insurance, for example. You may know these terms, but whole life premiums are paid for a lifetime or a set period of years, such as 1, 10, 20, or 30. It's a pre-tax, the advantage of a whole life policy, it's a pre-tax growth of cash value, which can be borrowed back, usually at a favorable rate. It's essentially a forced, relatively low interest savings program. Now, whole life fell into people didn't think much of it. Not too long ago, the idea was buy term, cash out your whole. I did that, and then I discovered what my term insurance was going to cost me in a few years. I've gone back to whole life with some term supplemented. The way you buy insurance is the way you should buy anything. Now, when you go out to buy a car, how do you buy a car? Well, if you're like many people, you kick the tires, close the door, be sure it has a good sound, solid sound. If you're sophisticated, you might check the mileage, gas mileage, and decide, and the color and the appearance, and you decide on the car, right? Well, that's not the best way to buy a car. The way you should buy a car is go out and find the purchase price. Figure out how long you're going to keep it, say 5 years, and evaluate, come up with a figure of how much you're going to sell that car for. Then you know what your cash outlay for the car is going to be. You check with your insurance man and find out what is the best car for insurance, lowest premiums, lowest rates. Then you get your mileage. You talk to your auto mechanic and find out what the repair ratio is. You run a figure on all those. You come up with a cost per mile to drive that car. And you base your decision on that, or at least partially on that. Same with life insurance. And my illustration earlier about term versus whole life is I discovered that term was going to cost me an awful lot of money to have the coverage I needed in the future. Or at least I felt I needed in the future. What's term insurance? Term insurance is called pure insurance because there's no savings involved. You're strictly buying protection. There's various kinds of term insurance. Fixed amount of insurance with increasing premiums. You might buy a $100,000 policy, and this year you spend $500. Next year it might be $600 for the same policy. Why? Because the chances of your passing away are greater, so the risk is greater, so your premium is greater. Or you might buy decreasing term. I have one decreasing term policy where your premium stays the same, but your value of the insurance decreases each year. A good example of decreasing term insurance is Annexed. That's homeowner's insurance. When you buy a home, you better believe that your bank or whoever you buy from is going to suggest or require you to have a homeowner's policy. If they suggest it, shop, because usually the policy they're selling you costs more than you can buy elsewhere for the same coverage. And besides, a surviving spouse might prefer to have the money rather than have a paid-off house.
What was that again? Say that whole thing one more time.
If you're buying a home, it's very normal. In fact, I've never heard of it where you're not suggested or required to buy a term insurance policy to cover the payment, to pay off the home, mm-hmm. Homeowner's policy. Usually those are high cost. You can get the same insurance elsewhere for less money.
A regular life insurance
policy. A regular term insurance policy from some local agent. And if a surviving spouse might prefer to have cash rather than a paid-off home. So it costs less and gives more flexibility, in my opinion. Variable life. Another type of insurance, relatively new, probably the way to go for most of us. It's a whole life cash values invested in common stocks or other high-yielding investments, and gives you a better chance of keeping pace with inflation. And I said I had a whole life policy. Actually, I have a variable life policy that I replaced my term with. And that, again, the premiums are similar to the 1, 5, 10, 20-year lifetime. The length of premium payments. Flexible premium variable life, I'm not too familiar with that policy, that kind of policy, but basically the insured can decide on a regular basis or periodic basis the amount of insurance they want and the size premium they want. So it's variable, it's flexible. Now, how much insurance is enough? I, like Scott, I grew up thinking that insurance was sin, similar to savings accounts, and then since then I've made certain decisions or conclusions, like if I'm trusting God, you know, if I don't have insurance, who's trusting God, me or my wife? I better ask her first if she wants to trust God in that area. First Timothy 5:8 says, if anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially his immediate family, what has he accomplished? He has a bad testimony. He has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Other insurance, disability. Disability is high cost, but it's important because statistically it's 3.5 times greater chance that a 35-year-old man will be disabled for 6 months than he will die. And who pays the bills when you're not able to work? By the way, Social Security does provide disability, but it's hard to get, and there's not much there. Health insurance, lots of different kinds of policies. Two common ones, major medical, comprehensive. The reason I put these two terms down here was watch out for terminology. Major medical comprehensive sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But it's specific medical expenses, small deductible, up to a relatively small maximum limit. Major medical, however, covers all types of medical insurance with an overall maximum and deductible and coinsurance. In other words, the Navigators have a major medical policy without a limit. Or some companies have a $1 million limit. And it's amazing how quickly you can go through a limited health insurance policy if you develop a catastrophic disease. A good friend of mine, I think he's taking a treatment that's keeping him alive, I think, but it's costing, one part of his treatment is costing $7,000 a month. It's pretty expensive. I haven't talked to him about it personally, but I've heard that from somebody else. Homeowner's insurance. Now, if you're really smart on your homeowner's insurance, you get the cheapest you can get, right? Wrong. There's various forms. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Some are very specialized. If you own a remodeled antique, you can get a certain kind of insurance. But HO3 or all risk is usually, or the broad form, is usually your best insurance. And if you compare policies, you'll discover that the differences in coverages are staggering. All risk will cover everything that happens to your house and a good portion of your contents. And it may cost you $100 more a month, $100 more a year, pardon me, than the next, which will cover which is much more restrictive in what it will pay for. And we're talking about $200 to $300 to $400 a year maximum anyway. On your homeowner's insurance, it's good to keep track of the amount of insurance you have. Homes do appreciate in value. And the replacement cost provision can become a nightmare. And most policies require that your home be insured for 80% of its value, current value, or current replacement cost, probably more basically said. If it's not insured for 80% of its replacement cost, or insured for less, not more, but less, you'll receive a fractional percentage of the amount of damage your home sustained or building sustained. And I have the formula the insurance company will use. The face value of the policy minus or divided by 80% of the replacement cost equals the percentage that you will receive. And, of course, if you have a deductible, which is always good to have, that self-insurance, it reduces your overall costs. That ends up with the amount you receive. For example, if you had a $100,000 home, where's the overhead? You stole my overhead.
There's one on there?
No. Here. I can write in the glass. Oh, right in front of me. Thank you. Where would I be without Scott, right? Thanks, Scott. Let's say your home is worth $100,000. And you had it insured for $70,000. And if your home had this 80% replacement cost provision, and let's say you had a $25,000 fire. I had a fire in my house last night. Didn't cost $25,000, but, you know. By the way, speaking of
the fireplace,
it did.
Yes, it did.
No, it wasn't the fireplace. It was in the garage. My son was involved in that. My 14-year-old was behaving yesterday like a 2 at the moment. But when I told him that he would have to pay for the damages out of his savings account, he was really upset because he said, "Now I'm not going to have any money for college." I told him that was my job, not his, getting money for college. But anyway. But $25,000 loss, and it was insured for 70 rather than 80. What would the results be? Well, I did some math here, but 70. If you can read my writing, is that readable? Divided by 80 is what? Any good mathematicians? I'm not. It's 88%. What's 88% of a $25,000 loss? It is 21,875. So if that was your situation, that's the amount of insurance you would get from the insurance company, and you would have to come up with about $3,200 yourself. Not a good decision. I was looking for a passage in Proverbs, and the phrase that stuck with me is get the facts. And I couldn't find it when I was scanning through the Bible.
It's the living.
Yeah. But at any rate, get the facts. Now, on the HO3, you are also reimbursed 10% other structures like a fence, 10% of the amount of insurance you have on your home, or 50% of the value of your home is you can collect in terms for contents, and loss of use if your home is completely destroyed, 20%. So if you have $100,000 insurance or $80,000 policy, these illustrate you can get $8,000 for other structures, $40,000 for contents, and $20,000 for loss of use. I mean, no, 4,000. What's 20% of 8,000? Whatever it is, for loss of use. Liability is also an important area. People tend to pick the lowest liability they can get on their auto insurance and on their homeowner's insurance. Bad decision. Because for most of us, that is our primary defense against a suit. What if Conrad and his buddy were messing around yesterday and the other boy got burned? Could it happen? Very sobering experience for these two kids. They're normally very good kids. They just were dumb that day, that moment. And but what would have happened? Well, we you know, more than likely those parents would have come back to us. And if you know anything about medical costs, you know it doesn't take much to go through a number of thousands of dollars. In fact, many people advise getting an umbrella policy in addition to your homeowners for $1 million or more. How much would a $1 million umbrella policy cost you, do you think, if you had the maximum, say, $300,000 on your home and on your auto?
$75?
You're right on.
How much?
$75 a year. Very nominal.
Can you mow the car and the house then?
No.
Why
they're tied. The umbrella takes over at those levels. And usually to buy it from the same company. Retirement. How much income do you need when you retire? Any ideas? What's that?
It depends.
It depends. Lots of things. Well, one criteria, that's a good point, varies tremendously. One criteria for income is between 67 and 80% of your current salary, assuming you want to maintain the same lifestyle. Now, if you're a pastor and really struggling financially, that may not be a good criteria. Maybe you need 100% of your current salary.
It assumes your current salary is adequate.
Is adequate, right. But, generally speaking, then that's a big spread, isn't it? Between 67 and 80%. How much do normal retirement programs, plus including Social Security, provide, by the way?
50 or 60.
50, I've heard 50, 55. But, you know, same idea. Modest. Where does the extra money come from?
Investments.
Or some savings program, as Scott was talking about. So one of the things you need to do, I need to do, we all need to do, is sit down on a regular basis, perhaps yearly, and think through the future. Where are we going? When are we going to get there? And what do we need when we arrive? And for some of us, that's a long ways away. For others, it's not that far, relatively speaking. How much income will a surviving spouse need? 1 Timothy 5:8 talks about my responsibility to provide for my family. I take that as a, you know, it used to be that people lived, you know, I would be ancient, you know, back in biblical times, wouldn't I? 52 years old. The average lifespan was around 35, if I recall correctly. You didn't have to worry about the future too much, or worry, poor term. You didn't plan for the future too much. But, you know, more than likely my wife will outlive me by 12 years. And I have a responsibility, I feel, biblically, to do the best I can to provide for that contingency. So how much will my surviving spouse need? On the table here, I have a memo to my loved ones. It's an excellent book to organize data and information just to organize information for a surviving spouse as to, you know, where's the insurance, where are the deeds, where's the will, and part of it is the widow's budget or widower's budget. And I think it's prudent to sit down with a spouse and to go through a budget and figure out what changes there would be over your current budget. You know, you might sell one car, would you move back home, would you keep the house, you know, what would happen? And then you simply do a quick projection of income from all sources, Social Security, retirement, what have you, and expenses, and figure out where the shortfall is. And by the way, that's how you determine how much life insurance you need. Ever seen that kind of a figure? Let's say that, just pick some figures out of the air. Carolyn, my wife, needs $20,000 a year, would need $20,000 a year as a widow. And let's say the combination of Social Security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is $10,000. Guess what? She's $10,000 a year short. Okay? Well, how do we provide for that? Well, if Carolyn is young, and or has a skill and has the interest and has the capacity, she could go out and get a job, couldn't she? Most people earn at least $10,000 a year. Problem solved. However, in our situation, we've got two young kids and we're in our 50s. And it's all of our energy is invested in taking care of the kids. Now, when Carolyn was on vacation, or she went not on vacation, but she went to Texas a couple of years ago, and I stayed home with two more or less teenagers for the first time and kept the job going and kept the house going. And my conclusion was I had adequate insurance because I wouldn't want her to have to do what I was trying to do because I was going bananas trying to maintain a job plus the kids. So our option is insurance. Now, how much insurance do you need to provide $10,000 a year? Income.
$100,000.
More.
Good point. That's right. Interest rates are down. But again, but you get the idea. Actually, you would want more for two reasons. First of all, $10,000 a year this year is great. $10,000 a year 10 years from now is going to be what? Less. So you'd want more than the initial $100,000 so you could not spend all the income earned to keep that account or that balance growing, so it would, on a yearly basis, throw off more money. And interest rates vary. And of course, you can always take, you know, you can always dip into the cash and dip into the asset if need be. What happens if you can't afford $100,000 worth of insurance? If you only afford 50, well, you trust God, right? What happens if you can afford $100,000 worth of insurance? You trust God. You know, we get confused as to when we're trusting God and when we're not trusting God, don't we? We're always trusting the Lord, no matter what our circumstances are. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that, okay? Assuming you didn't know it. Retirement plans, IRA, beginning in 87, you may contribute, you may continue to contribute $2,000 in a tax-deferred IRA if you are married and earn under $40,000 per year and file jointly, or are single and earn under $25,000 a year. That's $40,000 or under and $25,000 or under. You can still contribute. Some people would argue with my next statement here, but the IRA offers a variable retirement program, and if you want to discuss that later, I'd be glad to. Tax-sheltered annuity, that's something rather unique to pastors. Anybody who works for a 501c3 organization, an educational institution, a church, or what have you. Tax-sheltered annuity is what it says. It's an annuity. Annuity is a fixed guaranteed lifetime payment. Very much like an IRA, only available to someone who is working for a charity or a public educational institution. An excellent program, very similar to an IRA. Differences are you can contribute up to $30,000 on a yearly basis or up to 25% of your salary, whichever is less. And there is provisions for larger contributions, and I never have quite figured out what those provisions are. They take about 8 pages in a book to read, and then once you've read it, you don't understand it. But basically, if you haven't contributed the maximum in the past, you can bring yourself up to speed, as the expression goes. A tremendous program, I think, for people who qualify. A great program. And I think it's something that each church should really seriously consider for their staffs. Either as they can reduce their salary or as a pension plan for a church. Social Security, how am I doing time-wise? Not too bad. Retirement at age 62, full benefits up to 80%. Retirement at age 65, full benefits. I just read today that there are plans afoot to increase the normal retirement age, at least as far as Social Security is concerned, age 67. Survivor's benefits, there are some. In fact, they're very good, really. They're also possible for parents if you're currently supporting them. A disability, I mentioned that earlier, it's a good fallback, but there's not much there. It's tough to qualify for Social Security disability. And then there's a 4% increase in benefits each year if you continue to work between age 65 and 70, quite significant. Now, I have a brother-in-law that retired from the pastorate early. He got burnt out, in my opinion. I think he should have took a sabbatical rather than retire. So he is receiving less benefits. By the way, he's only receiving Social Security. The church had nothing for him. And I'm an elder in the church, and I think it's our responsibility to work with our staff to be sure that they have adequate income. Benefits from Social Security are really put down. And then there are problems. But not many people realize that for a 35-year-old man to have the benefits that Social Security provides him, is equivalent to a life insurance or insurance of about $900,000. Quite significant. That's health, retirement, disability, the whole nine yards. It would cost, the face value of those policies would be close to $900,000. Okay, wills. You know what they say? Where there's a will, there's a relative, right? No. Little humor. Not much, granted. Important consideration. By the way, you'll notice we're going rather quickly, okay? And if you have questions, we'd be glad to interact with you afterwards. Key decisions on a will is personal administrator, or executor, or executrix, as the term is sometimes used. This is the person who is the business manager of the estate. After a person passes away, this is the person who's named in the will, who kind of gets all the information on the assets in one group and all the information on the debts in the other group and pays off the debts and then distributes what's left according to terms of the will. What do you really need? What's the key thing you need in a personal administrator, in my experience or my observation? You need a legal whiz? Do you need a financial manager? Doesn't hurt. But what you really need is someone who has the well-being of the surviving of the survivors at heart. You want somebody who's empathetic and sympathetic. And who is more empathetic and sympathetic with the survivors other than the survivors? I am the executor of Carolyn's will. She is the executor of my will. And we've named alternate executors in case the surviving spouse can't handle or doesn't want to handle the responsibility. Now, that makes some people nervous because I've got some, I don't know, understand finances. They can go out and hire the expertise. You have to get an attorney anyway. And they may have to hire an accountant. They may have to hire a realtor or a broker or what have you. But the expertise is out there. But you want someone who understands the needs of what's going on. Next important decision is guardian. If you have young kids, you need to select a guardian. You need to always select a guardian and alternate in case the original guardian can't handle that responsibility. Well, by the way, with the
administrator... Can I just ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Wills are not made for couples together, huh?
Used to be a common thing to have a joint will.
That's what we have. But
I would suggest you talk to your attorney and have it changed. I would suggest you talk to your attorney and have it changed. Now, I'm not an attorney, and I make a point of not practicing law. And I have seen a joint will, and it was drafted in Oklahoma, and I questioned it to the people I saw, and they went to their attorney, and he thought my questions were dumb. So I guess my interpretation is it may work in their situation or in their state. But the problem with a joint will is that it takes the form of a contract. In effect, the effect of a contract, and ties up the surviving spouse, gives them less flexibility.
You just divide your community property down the middle, or a certain percentage?
In my situation, I've given everything to Carolyn, and in her situation, she's given everything to me, and then the ultimate distribution is through our estates. But of course, our estate isn't very large. We have an estate of, it's under $600,000, which, you know, will next year be the exemption equivalent, if you know what that term means. Right now, you can give $500,000 away to anybody you want to without incurring an inheritance tax. Next year, it's $600,000. Anything over that amount next year, you'll be taxed on. Your estate will be taxed on. The inheritance tax is a tax on the right to give away property. Yes, sir?
May I add a comment back under A?
Yes.
Integrity. Well, I tell you, when being pastor of a church for the last several years, we've had people die. That executor better be honest.
Yep.
Because I've run into situations where, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's a good point. But anyway, a joint will may or may not be appropriate for your situation, but I would encourage you. Is it an old will? I mean, it's been around for a while?
Yeah, we're just in the process of having it redone now.
Well, I would suggest that you discuss it with your attorney in terms of which would be better.
What if both, for example, if on the way home, you know, our plane goes down, then you have an assistant or an alternate.
Now, you always name an alternate.
Two wills then.
You always name, in terms of executor or administrator.
Yeah, as well as the beneficiaries.
Oh yes, you should always. You should always. Well, in our situation. Well, let me get that later on, if I may. All right. Okay. But in terms of administrator, you always name a primary and an alternate, because it's always same with the guardian. Name a primary and an alternate. Because sometimes who you name can't handle the responsibility, you know, X number of years down the road if that need arises. And it's always good to tell people, by the way. Yeah, surprise, surprise. The probate judge calls up and says, "Did you know?" "No, we didn't know that." Trustee. Trustee is, now not everyone wants a trust, not everyone needs a trust, but in my opinion, if you have small kids, you should have a trust. Or minors. You need a trust. A trust separates benefit from responsibility. Now, Conrad and Rochelle's 10, Conrad's 14. If Carol and I predecease them before they get through college, they are going to need someone to manage their assets for them, to pay for their college and or high school expenses and what have you. Because I know what would happen to Conrad at age 18 if he inherited our estate, even though it's all that big, but there'd be a Porsche or something, a Lamborghini. We were talking about that driving up, sitting in our front yard right away. I mean, that's, you look at the walls in his room, and that's, you know, that's his interest. Rochelle would buy horses. Good decision, bad decision, I have an opinion. So we protect them from making that decision. Now, of course, some people would say, well, I trust my guardian with my kids. Why shouldn't I trust my guardian with my money? Well, let me ask you a question. When was the last time your guardian invested $200,000 or $500,000 successfully? When was the last time my wife invested that amount of money? When was the last time I invested that amount of money successfully? Is your guardian qualified? Are you doing them any favor? And then here's my guardian, and I'm Conrad, and I go to say, "Mr. Morton is my guardian. I'd like $10,000 of my money for a car." He's not only responsible for my money, he's responsible for my conduct. And I say, and he says,
"No way.
No way.
You don't want you to have all those."
And guess who I get mad at? My parent. Yeah. But if I go to the trustee and say, "Mr. Trustee, I'd like..." And he says, "No." I go to my guardian and say, "You know what that guy told me?" He sympathizes with me and helps me understand it, hopefully. So a trustee is always frequently beneficial. Now, there's various kinds of wills. If you're going to have a will, you can have a non-cupative will, a self-proved will, a holographic will. I don't recommend any of them. That's the will, you do it yourself. Remember, I'm not an attorney. Non-cupative, that's the kind where you're dying, and two or three witnesses are standing around you, and you say, "I'd like to give this, this, and this away," and they say, "Uh-huh," and one of them writes it out, and they all sign it, and it becomes a legally binding document, legal document. Self-proved, that's where you can send to the ABC Legal Service a buck and a half, and they'll send you a form, and you fill the form out, and you take it in to have it notarized or whatever your state requires, and you've got a will, legally binding document. Holographic is when you write it all in your own writing. The problem with these things are some are legal in some states, some are not, and people move around. Is it legal in your state? Is it legal in the states where you own property? And besides, will it accomplish your purpose? And that's why you have a will, to accomplish certain purposes. And I'd like to have, and when I have surgery, or when I have my car worked on, or when I have whenever I want to accomplish something significant, I want to get someone who has an expertise involved in it. Make sense? Okay. When to review your will? Anytime you move, anytime there's a change in assets, change in insurance, anytime there's a change in family circumstances, a birth, death, divorce, not necessarily on a yearly basis, but wills relate to goals. So anytime your family changes is when you want to review a will. And then consider a living will or a trust. Um, and this is what Carol and I have done. I think I'll try to answer your question now if I can. If I don't answer your question on what you should do, if I don't answer your question, ask it again. But I think a living will or revocable will, a living trust or revocable trust is probably one of the best things we have going for us today. And Carol and I have set one up. We're the trustor. We've set the trust up. We're also the trustee. I've set up a trust. And so our house is owned by the trust. Our life insurance is payable to the trust. Our investments, we have some mutual funds. They're owned by the trust. We don't own them. What's one advantage of that? About our checking account, it doesn't say it on our check. I thought it'd be a little ostentatious to say the Russell P. and Carolyn Reed Trust, so it just says Russell P. and Carolyn Reed, but it's a trust account. It's owned by the trust. What's the advantage of that? Well, by the way, you know, eventually Carolyn and I will die, unless the Lord comes. But you know, trusts don't die. So anything owned by the trust avoids what? Oh no, can't avoid taxes.
Probate.
There's no probate expenses taken out. Now, I should add that a living trust usually costs a little bit more than a will to set up. May cost more than a will, depending on how complicated your will is. We have inherited some property in Texas and in North Dakota. Any place you own property, your will is probated. Trusts don't die. If the property in Texas and North Dakota are owned by the trust rather than Russell, my wife or I, guess what? There's no probate costs. So you can greatly reduce, notice I didn't say avoid, you can greatly reduce the probate cost, cost of probate, which are basically attorney fees, legal fees, court costs, appraisals, you know, what have you. In our situation, our trust says, and also, we're the trustee. Not only am I the trustor, person who's placed assets into the trust, but I'm also the trustee, I'm the manager. And that's why there's no tax savings. Because as trustee, I have control. And the IRS says, let's not play any games. Russ and Carolyn, if you control those assets, they're really still yours. So we're going to charge you taxes on them. Any inheritance tax or any income earned by the trust assets, the investments, it's passed on to us. It's considered our income. So there's no way to avoid taxes with a revocable trust. An irrevocable trust, you can avoid taxes. So we're the trustor, we're the trustee, we're also the beneficiary.
So, in the event of your death, then your children will become trustees?
Or in the event of my death, Carolyn becomes a trustee.
Both of you are in?
Both of our deaths, we have named somebody else a trustee, because the kids aren't responsible. In fact, the kids don't control those funds until they're age 35. Because that's not unusual. People usually make dumb decisions. No, I'm seriously. In my opinion, people don't know how to handle large amounts of money and as a rule until they're older. But that's a good point, because people vary tremendously. I was talking to a friend of mine who does the same kind of work I do. And he was explaining how they were reorganizing their estate, and they were dropping their trusts, going to wills, and Kathy, who was in college, would get equal distribution if John and Patty passed away. And he finished explaining it to me, and he said, I know what you're thinking. He said, what about Kathy? Oh, it's actually Vicky. I said, that's right, John, that did occur to me. What about, how come you're giving, she said, she is the best financial manager in the entire family. She'll do better with her funds than Patty and I do, and the rest of the kids put together. So you make decisions, not arbitrarily, but based on the people. Now, telling some family secrets, I've discussed this with Carolyn. And she said, well, boy, if you pass away before I do, I don't know that I want that responsibility of managing those assets. Because she has never invested a few hundred thousand dollars before, successfully or unsuccessfully. And so the trust, when I pass away, if I predecease her, the trust remains a revocable trust, but the trust names an alternate trustee. to step in and handle the responsibility. It puts somebody between her and her assets that she'll have to go through to get funds. Now, she can get all the money she wants, and she can fire that person or the institution. She can change it. She can take it over herself. She has complete control. I firmly believe in that. But she's got someone that she knows she has to go through and can interact with her on her wishes and desires. Very. So, now, did I answer your question? Okay, good. I hoped I would.
Well, I'm going to ask you another question.
Any other questions? We're running over time. But
who sets these up, lawyers?
Yes.
Now, right. Why would they set those up if it avoids attorney fees? Like, we just got a lawyer here, and we asked about a trust, and he just said, your state's not big enough to...
a will is not a bad document. I don't mean to imply that. And a will might be ideal because it depends on what your objectives are. But I think, again, this verse in Proverbs, I can't think of the reference, get the facts. I think it's beneficial. We, as good stewards, we have to know what we want. For example, our first will, when we got Conrad, the attorney said, you don't need a guardian. Okay. We went home, discussed it, and let's see. Now, if it doesn't go, it'll go to some. Well, no, they wouldn't be good. Or it goes, no, they wouldn't be good. We went back, and he said, you don't need a guardian. And I said, yes, we do. And the guardian we want is so-and-so. And you know what he said? Okay. So we told him what we wanted. So I think some attorneys may not think the way, they may disagree, your state laws may vary, but often, second opinions are beneficial. Talk to more than one attorney.
And make them explain it in common language. Yeah, understand.
That's right. Yes, sir?
Most banks and savings institutions have trust departments, and they're very helpful. We have a banker and attorney who's a believer. Mm-hmm. Extremely helpful to go to him for advice and counsel.
Sure.
And a lot of you will tell you they do a very good job.
Right. Other questions? We've thoroughly enjoyed the time. If you have any personal questions, be glad to interact with you. I brought some literature up in addition to Scott Scissors. There's a memo to my loved one. This, which is, I think, is a tremendous little booklet to have. I'll unhook myself now, all right?